her ration to a starving boy. He was already dead, his tiny hand outstretched, waiting for a piece of bread. We had no doctor or nurse in camp, only a veterinarian from Estonia. We relied on him. He did his best, but the conditions were unsanitary. He had no medicine. Ivanov and the NKVD wouldn't step inside our yurtas. They yelled at us to leave the dead outside the door. "You're all filthy pigs. You live in filth. It's no wonder you're dying." Dysentery, typhus, and scurvy crawled into camp. Lice feasted on our open sores. One afternoon, one of the Finns left his wood chopping to urinate. Yanina found him swinging from a branch. He had hanged himself with a fishing net. We had to trek farther and farther to find wood. We were nearly 5 kilometers from camp. At the end of the day, Yanina clung by my side.
"Liala showed me something," she said.
"What's that?" I said, stuffing twigs into my pockets for our stove and my paintbrushes. Yanina looked around.
"Come here. I'll show you."
She took my hand and walked me down the edge of the tree line and into the snow. She reached out her mitten, pointing. "What is it?" I asked. My eyes scanned the snow.
"Shh!"
She pulled me closer and pointed. I saw it. A huge owl lay in the snow at the edge of the trees. Its white feathers blended so well that at first I didn't see it. Its body looked to be nearly 2 feet long. The large raptor had tiny brown speckles on its head and trunk.
"Is he sleeping?" asked Yanina.
"I think it's dead," I replied. I took a stick from my pocket and poked at the wing. The owl didn't move. "Yes, it's dead."
"Do you think we should eat him?" asked Yanina.
At first I was shocked. Then I imagined the plump body roasting in our barrel like a chicken. I poked at it again. I grabbed its wing and pulled. It was heavy but slid across the snow.
"No, you can't drag him. The NKVD will see. They'll take him away from us," said Yanina. "Hide him in your coat."
"Yanina, this owl is enormous. I can't hide him in my coat." The thought of a dead owl in my coat made me shiver.
"But I'm so hungry," cried Yanina. "Please, I'll walk in front of you. No one will see."
I was hungry too. So was Mother. So was Jonas. I leaned over the owl and pushed its wings against its belly. It was stiff. Its face looked sharp, menacing. I didn't know if I could put it against my body. I looked at Yanina. She nodded, her eyes wide. I glanced around. "Unbutton my coat." Her little hand set to work. I lifted the dead raptor and held it against my chest. Shivers of revulsion rolled through my body. "Hurry, button me up." She couldn't button the coat. The owl was too large. I could barely get my coat around its body.
"Turn him around so his face doesn't stick out," said Yanina. "He'll blend in with the snow. Let's hurry."
Hurry? How was I supposed to walk 5 kilometers pregnant with a dead owl without the NKVD noticing?
"Yanina, slow down. I can't walk fast. It's too big."
The horned beak poked at my chest. Its dead body was creepy, but I was so hungry. Other deportees looked at me.
"Our mamas are sick. They need food. Will you help us?" explained Yanina.
People I didn't know formed a circle around me, sheltering me from view. They escorted me safely back to our yurta undetected. They didn't ask for anything. They were happy to help someone to succeed at something, even if they weren't to benefit. We'd been trying to touch the sky from the bottom of the ocean. I realized that if we boosted one another, maybe we'd get a little closer. Yanina's mother plucked the owl. We all crowded around the makeshift stove to smell it cook.
"It smells like duck, don't you think?" said Jonas.
"Let's pretend it's duck." The taste of warm meat was heavenly. It didn't matter that it was a bit tough. The experience lasted longer because we had to chew. We imagined we were at a royal banquet. Can't you just taste the gooseberry marinade? Sighed Mrs. Remus.
This is wonderful. Thank you, Lina, said Mother.
Thank you, Nina. She found the owl, I said.
Leola found him,
corrected Yanina.
Thanks, Yanina, said Jonas.
Yanina beamed, holding a fistful of feathers. Chapter 78. Christmas came. We had made it halfway through winter. That was something to be grateful for. The weather continued relentless. Just as one storm passed, another queued at its heels. We lived the life of penguins, freezing under layers of ice and snow. Mrs. Remus stood outside the bakery. The smell of butter and cocoa made her cry. The NKVD made cakes and pastries in their bakery. They ate fish, drank hot coffee, and enjoyed canned meats and vegetables from America. After a meal, they'd play cards, smoke cigarettes, maybe a cigar, and drink a snifter of brandy. Then they'd light the fire in their brick barracks and cover themselves with their fur blankets. My drawings became smaller. I didn't have much paper. Mother didn't have much energy. She couldn't even sit up for the Kuchos Christmas celebration. She had lain too long. Her hair was frozen to a board. She drifted in and out of sleep, waking only to blow a kiss when she felt us near. The lice brought typhus. The repeater fell ill. He insisted on leaving our yurta.
You're such nice people. It's too dangerous for you all. Dangerous, he said.
Yes, get out of here, said the bald man.
He moved to a yurta where people had similar symptoms. Fever, rash, some delirium. Mrs. Remus and I helped him walk. 4 days later, I saw his naked body, eyes wide open, stacked in a heap of corpses. His frostbitten hand was missing. White foxes had eaten into his stomach, exposing his innards and staining the snow with blood. I turned and covered my eyes.
Lina, please take those books off the table, said Mother.
I can't stand to see such ghastly images. Not at breakfast.
But that's what inspired Edvard Munch's art. He saw these images not as death, but as birth, I said.
Off the table, said Mother. Papa chuckled behind his newspaper.
But Papa, listen to what Munch said.
Papa lowered the newspaper. I turned to the page. He said, from my rotting body flowers shall grow, and I am in them, and that is eternity. Isn't that beautiful? Papa smiled at me.
You're beautiful because you see it that way.
Lina, take the books off the table, please, said Mother.
Papa winked at me.
We must do something, I cried to Jonas and Mrs. Remus. We can't let people die like this.
We'll do our best. That's all we have, said Mrs. Remus. And we'll pray for a miracle.
No, don't talk like that. We will survive, I said. Right, Jonas?
Jonas nodded.
Are you feeling unwell? I asked him.
I'm fine, he replied.
That night I sat with Mother's head in my lap. Lice marched triumphantly across her forehead. I flicked them off.
Did you apologize?
Asked Mother, gazing at me through heavy eyelids.
To whom?
To Nikolai. You told him you hated him.
I do hate him, I said.
He could help us. He chooses not to.
He helped me,
said Mother softly. I looked down at her.
That day, when I went to meet the grouchy woman coming back from the village, it was dark. Some NKVD drove by. They began to taunt me. They lifted my dress. Nikolai came. He shooed the others off. He drove me the rest of the way. I begged him to find news of your father. We met the grouchy woman on the road in the dark. Nikolai dropped us 3 kilometers from camp. We walked the rest of the way. See? She said, lifting her face to mine. That helped me. And I think the commander found out about it. Nikolai was punished for it. I think that's why he's here.
He deserves to be here. Maybe he'll get sick and everyone will ignore him. Then he'll see how it feels. He could get a doctor for us.
Lena, think of what your father would say.
A wrongdoing doesn't give us the right to do wrong. You know that.
I thought about Papa. She was right. He would say something like that. Jonas walked into the yurta. How is she? He asked. I put my hand on my mother's forehead. She still has a high fever.
Darling, said Mother to Jonas, I'm so very cold. Are you cold?
Jonas took off his coat and handed it to me. He lay down beside Mother, wrapping himself around her.
Okay, put the coat on top of us. Get the small hide from Ilyushka, said Jonas.
Ilyushka, said Mother fondly.
I'll warm you, Mother, said Jonas, kissing her cheek. I feel better already, she said.
Chapter 79. I practiced the Russian words doctor, medicine, mother, please. My stomach jumped. I clutched the stone. I heard Andrus's voice.
Don't give them anything, Lena. Not even your fear.
It wasn't just Mother. The man who wound his watch was sick. Yanina's mother was sick. If I could just get some medicine. I hated the thought of asking them for anything. The NKVD had killed Papa. I hated them for it. I couldn't let them do the same to Mother. I saw Kretsky near the NKVD barracks. He stood with Ivanov. I waited. I wanted to speak to Kretsky alone. Time passed. I had to go to work in order to get my ration. I trudged through the snow toward them.
Look, it's a little pig, said Ivanov.
My mother is sick, I said.
Really?
He said, feigning concern.
I think I know something that might help.
I looked at him.
Give her plenty of sunshine, fresh fruits, and lots of vegetables.
He laughed at his own sick joke. We need a doctor. We need medicine, I said, shivering.
What else do you need? A bathhouse? A school? Well, you better get building. Davai!
I looked at Kretsky. Please, help me. We need a doctor. We need medicine. My mother is sick.
There is no doctor, said Kretsky.
Medicine, I said. We need medicine.
Do you want another 20 years?
Yelled Ivanov.
I can give you that. No bread today, you ingrate. Get to work. Davai!
I didn't get a doctor. I didn't get medicine. I lost my ration and humiliated myself in the process. I began walking to the trees. I had forgotten what the sun felt like on my face. When I closed my eyes, I could see sunlight in Lithuania and on Andrus's hair. But I couldn't imagine the sun on the Laptev Sea. Even if we did make it through the winter, would we have the strength to build things? Could we really build a bathhouse and a school? Who would be left to teach? I couldn't lose Mother. I would fight. I would do whatever it took. She trembled, slipping in and out of sleep. Jonas and I sandwiched her between us, trying to warm and comfort her. Mrs. Rimmis heated bricks to warm her feet. Yanina picked the lice off her eyelashes. The bald man leaned over and tucked his ration under Mother's hand.
Come on, woman. You're better than this. You've got children to take care of, for God's sake, he said.
Hours passed. Mother's teeth chattered, her lips turned blue.
Jonas! Keep this.
She handed him Papa's wedding band.
It's full of love. Nothing is more important.
Mother's trembling increased. She whimpered between breaths.
Please,
she pleaded, staring at us with urgent eyes.
Cost us.
We held her between us, our arms curled around her withered body. Jonas breathed quickly. His frightened eyes searched mine.
No,
he whispered.
Please.
Chapter 80. January 5th. Jonas held Mother through the lonely morning hours, rocking her gently, as she used to do with us. Mrs. Rimmis tried to feed her and massage circulation into her limbs. She couldn't eat or speak. I warmed bricks and shuttled them back and forth from the stove. I sat next to her, rubbing her hands and telling stories from home. I described every room in our house in detail, even the patterns on the spoon in the kitchen drawer. The cake is in the oven baking, and it's hot in the kitchen. So you've decided to open the window over the sink and let the warm breeze in. You can hear children playing outside, I told her. Later that morning, Mother's breathing became increasingly labored.
Warm more bricks, Lena, my brother told me. She's too cold.
Suddenly, Mother looked up at Jonas. She opened her mouth. Not a sound came out. The trembling stopped. Her shoulders relaxed and her head fell against him. Her eyes faded to a hollow stare.
Mother,
I said, moving closer. Mrs. Rimmis touched her hand to Mother's neck. Jonas began to cry, cradling her in his 11-year-old arms. Small whimpers became deep, racking sobs, shaking his entire body. I lay down beside him, hugging him. Mrs. Rimmis knelt beside us. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want, she began.
Mother,
cried Jonas. Tears spilled down my cheeks.
She had a beautiful spirit, said the man who wound his watch.
Janina stroked my hair.
I love you, Mother, I whispered. I love you, Papa.
Mrs. Rimmis continued. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen. It described Mother perfectly. Her cup overflowed with love for everyone and everything around her, even the enemy. Mrs. Rimmis began to cry.
Sweet Elena, she was so dear, so good to everyone. Please don't let them take her body, said Jonas to Mrs. Rimmis. I want to bury her. We can't let her be eaten by foxes.
We'll bury her, I assured Jonas through my tears.
We'll make a coffin. We'll use the boards we sleep on.
Jonas nodded. The bald man stared blankly, and for once, said nothing. She looks pretty, said Jonas, standing at the side of Grandma's coffin.
Papa, does she know I'm here?
She does, said Papa, putting his arm around us. She's watching, from above.
Jonas looked up toward the ceiling and then to Papa.
Remember last summer, when we flew the kite?
Said Papa. Jonas nodded.
The wind came, and I yelled to you that it was time. I told you to loosen your grip. The string started unwinding and the wooden spool spun through your hands. Remember? The kite went higher and higher. I had forgotten to tie the string to the spool. Do you remember what happened?
The kite disappeared into the sky, said Jonas.
Exactly. That's what happens when people die. Their spirit flies up into the blue sky, said Papa.
Maybe Grandma found the kite, said Jonas.
Maybe, said Papa.
The bald man sat, his elbows on his knees, talking to himself.
Why is it so hard to die?
He asked.
I helped turn you in. I said no too late. I saw the lists.
Mrs. Remus spun around.
What?
He nodded.
They asked me to confirm people's professions. They asked me to list the teachers, lawyers, and military who lived nearby.
And you did it? I said. Jonas held Mother, still crying.
I told them I would, said the bald man. And then I changed my mind. You traitor! You pathetic old man! I said. Pathetic, and yet I survive. Surely my survival is my punishment. That has to be it. This woman closes her eyes and she is gone. I've wished for death since the first day, and yet I survive. Can it really be so hard to die?
Chapter 81. I woke uneasy. The night had been unkind. I slept next to Mother's body, muffling my sobs so as not to scare Jonas. My beautiful mother. I would never see her smile again, feel her arms around me. I already missed her voice. My body felt hollow, like my sluggish heartbeat was bouncing and echoing through my vacant, aching limbs. The bald man's questions kept me awake in thought. Was it harder to die, or harder to be the one who survived? I was 16, an orphan in Siberia, but I knew. It was the one thing I never questioned. I wanted to live. I wanted to see my brother grow up. I wanted to see Lithuania again. I wanted to see Joanna. I wanted to smell the lily of the valley on the breeze beneath my window. I wanted to paint in the fields. I wanted to see Andrus with my drawings. There were only two possible outcomes in Siberia. Success meant survival. Failure meant death. I wanted life. I wanted to survive. Part of me felt guilty. Was it selfish that I wanted to live even though my parents were gone? Was it selfish to have wants beyond my family being together? I was now the guardian of my 11-year-old brother. What would he do if I perished? After work, Jonas helped the man who wound his watch make a coffin. Mrs. Remus and I prepared Mother. Is there anything left in her suitcase? Asked Mrs. Remus. I don't think so. I pulled Mother's suitcase from under the board she lay on. I was wrong. Inside were fresh, clean clothes. A light dress, silk stockings, shoes without scuffs, her tube of lipstick. There was also a man's shirt and tie. Papa's clothes. I began to cry. Mrs. Remus brought her hand to her mouth. She really intended to return home. I looked at Papa's shirt. I lifted it to my face. My mother was freezing. She could have worn these clothes. She kept them to return to Lithuania in a clean set of clothes. Mrs. Remus pulled out the silk dress. This is lovely. We'll put this on her. I took Mother's coat off of her. She had worn the coat since the night we were deported. Stitch marks and stray threads pocked the inside where she had sewn in our valuables. I lifted the fabric of the lining. A few papers remained. Those are deeds to your home and property in Kaunas, said Mrs. Remus, looking at the paperwork. Keep them safe. You'll need them when you go home. There was another small piece of paper. I unfolded it. It was an address. In Biberach, Germany. Germany? That has to be where my cousin is.
Probably, but you mustn't write to that address, said Mrs. Remus. It could get them in trouble.
That night, Jonas and I stole shovels and ice picks from outside the NKVD barracks.
It has to be someplace we'll remember, I told him, because we're taking her body back to Lithuania with us.
We walked to a little hill near the Laptev Sea. This has a nice view, said Jonas. We'll remember this. We dug all night, chipping away at the ice, digging as deep as we could. As morning approached, Mrs. Rimmis and the man who wound his watch arrived to help. Even Yanina and the bald man came to dig. The ice was so hard, the grave was fairly shallow. The next morning, Mrs. Rimmis slipped Mother's wedding band off her finger. "Keep this. Bury it with her when you take her back home." We carried the coffin out of the yurta and walked slowly through the snow toward the hill. Jonas and I held the front. Mrs. Rimmis and the man who wound his watch held the center, and the bald man carried the back. Yanina trailed beside me. People joined us. I didn't know them. They prayed for Mother. Soon, a large procession walked behind us. We passed the NKVD barracks. Kretzky talked with guards on the porch. He saw us and stopped talking. I looked ahead and walked toward the cold hole in the ground. Chapter 82. I painted a map to the gravesite using the ash mixture and a feather from the owl. Mother's absence left a gaping hole, a mouth missing its front tooth. The eternal grayness in camp became a shade darker. Amidst the polar night, our only sun had slipped under a cloud.
"We could drown ourselves," said the bald man. "That would be easy, right?"
No one responded.
"Don't ignore me, girl."
"I'm not ignoring you. Don't you understand? We're all tired of you,"
I said.
I was so very tired. Mentally, physically, emotionally, I was tired. "You always talk of death and of us killing ourselves. Haven't you figured it out? We are not interested in dying," I said.
"But I'm interested," he insisted.
"Maybe you don't really want to die," said Jonas. "Maybe you just think you deserve to."
The bald man looked up at Jonas, and then at me.
"You think of nothing but yourself. If you want to kill yourself, what's keeping you?" I said.
Silence sat between our stares.
"Fear," he said.
Two nights after we buried Mother, there was a whistle on the air. A storm would arrive the next day. I bundled in all that I could find and set out into the blackness to steal wood from the NKVD building. Each day when chopping and delivering wood, we dumped extra behind the pile. It was understood that if someone was brave enough to steal it, it was there. A man in Group 26 got caught stealing wood. They sentenced him to an additional 5 years. 5 years for one log. It could have been 50. Our sentences were dictated by our survival. I walked toward the NKVD barrack, making a wide circle to arrive at the back close to the woodpile. My face and ears were wrapped in a cloth with only my eyes exposed. I wore Mother's hat. A figure scurried past me, carrying a large plank of wood. Brave. The planks were leaned up against the barracks. I turned near the back of the woodpile. I stopped. A figure in a long coat stood behind the giant stacks of wood. It was impossible to see in the darkness. I turned slowly to leave, trying not to make a sound.
"Who's there? Show yourself."
I turned around.
"Group number?"
he demanded. 11, I said, backing away. The figure moved closer.
"Vilkas?"
I didn't respond. He stepped toward me. I saw his eyes under the large fur hat. Kretzky. He stumbled and I heard swishing. He carried a bottle.
"Stealing?"
he asked, taking a swig. I said nothing.
"I can't arrange for you to draw a portrait here. No one wants one," said Kretzky.
"You think I want to draw for you?"
"Why not?" he said. "It kept you warm, you got food, and you drew a nice, realistic portrait." He laughed.
"Realistic? I don't want to be forced to draw that way."
Why was I even talking to him? I turned to leave.
"Your mother," he said.
I stopped.
"She was a good woman. I could see she used to be very pretty.
I spun around.
What do you mean? She was always pretty. It's you that's ugly. You couldn't see her beauty, or anyone else's for that matter.
No, I saw it. She was pretty. Красивая.
No, not that word. I was supposed to learn it on my own, not from Kretzky.
It means beautiful, but with strength, he slurred. Unique.
I couldn't look at him. I looked at the logs. I wanted to grab one. I wanted to smash him across the face like the can of sardines.
So you hate me? He laughed.
How could Mother have tolerated Kretzky? She claimed he had helped her.
I hate me too, he said.
I looked up.
You want to draw me like this? Like your beloved Munk?
He asked. His face looked puffy. I could barely understand his slurred Russian.
I know about your drawings.
He pointed a shaky finger at me.
I've seen them all.
He knew about my drawings. How did you know about my father? I asked. He ignored my question.
My mother, she was an artist too,
he said, gesturing with the bottle.
But she is with yours.
Dead. I'm sorry, I said instinctively. Why did I say that? I didn't care.
You're sorry?
He snorted in disbelief, tucking the bottle under his arm and rubbing his gloves together.
My mother, she was Polish. She died when I was 5. My father is Russian. He remarried a Russian when I was 6. My mother wasn't even cold a year. Some of my mother's relatives are in Kolyma. I was supposed to go there to help them. That's why I wanted to leave the barge in Yakutsk. But now I'm here. So you're not the only one who is in prison.
He took another swig of the bottle.
You want to steal wood, Vilkas?
He opened his arms.
Steal wood.
He waved his hand toward the pile.
Dvai!
My ears burned. My eyelids stung from the cold. I walked to the woodpile.
The woman my father married, she hates me too. She hates Poles.
I took a log. He didn't stop me. I began to pile wood. I heard a sound. Kretzky's back was turned, the bottle hanging from his hand. Was he sick? I took a step away with the logs. I heard it again. Kretzky wasn't sick. He was crying.
Leave Lina. Hurry. Take the wood. Just go.
I took a step to leave him. Instead, my legs walked toward him, still holding the wood. What was I doing? The sound coming from Kretzky was uncomfortable, stifled.
Nikolai?
He didn't look at me. I stood there silent.
Nikolai?
I reached out from under the wood. I put a hand on his shoulder. I'm sorry, I finally said. We stood in the darkness, saying nothing. I turned to leave him.
Vilkas.
I turned.
I'm sorry for your mother, he said.
I nodded. Me too. Chapter 83. I had played through scenarios of how I would get back at the NKVD. How I would stomp on the Soviets if I ever had a chance. I had a chance. I could have laughed at him, thrown wood at him, spit in his face. The man threw things at me, humiliated me. I hated him, right? I should have turned and walked away. I should have felt good inside. I didn't. The sound of his crying physically pained me. What was wrong with me? I told no one of the incident. The next day, Kretzky was gone. February arrived. Yanina was fighting scurvy. The man who wound his watch had dysentery. Mrs. Remus and I tended to them as best we could. Yanina spoke to her dead dolly for hours, sometimes yelling or laughing. After a few days, she stopped speaking. What are we to do? I said to Jonas. Yanina's getting sicker by the minute. He looked at me. What is it?
I said.
I have the spots again, he said.
Where? Let me see. The scurvy spots had reappeared on Jonas's stomach. Clumps of his hair had fallen out.
There are no tomatoes this time, said Jonas. Andrus isn't here.
He started shaking his head. I grabbed my brother by the shoulders. Jonas, listen to me. We are going to live. Do you hear me? We're going home. We are not going to die. We're going home to our house. And we're going to sleep in our beds with the goose down comforters. We will, all right?
How will we live alone, without mother and papa?
He asked. Auntie and uncle, and Joanna. They'll help. We'll have Auntie's apple cakes and donuts with jam inside. The ones you like, okay? And Andrus will help us. Jonas nodded. Say it. Say we're going home.
We're going home,
repeated Jonas. I hugged him, kissing the scabbed bald spot on his head. Here. I took the stone from Andrus out of my pocket and held it up to Jonas. He seemed dazed and didn't take the stone. My stomach sank. What would I do? I had no medicine. Everyone was ill. Would I be the only one left? Alone with the bald man? We took turns going for rations. I begged at other yurtas as mother had done on the beet farm. I walked into a yurta. Two women sat amongst four people who were covered as if sleeping. They were all dead.
Please don't tell, they pleaded. We want to bury them once the storm ends. If the NKVD discover they're dead, they'll throw them out into the snow.
I won't tell, I assured them. The storm raged. The sound of the wind echoed between my stinging ears. The wind blew so cold like white fire. I fought my way back to our yurta. Bodies stacked like firewood were covered in snow outside the huts. The man who wound his watch hadn't returned.
I'll go look for him, I said to Mrs. Rimmis.
He could barely walk, said the bald man. He probably went to the closest yurta when the winds came. Don't risk it.
We have to help one another, I told him. But how could I expect him, of all people, to understand?
You need to stay here. Jonas is not well.
Mrs. Rimmis looked over to Janina.
Her mother? I asked.
I took her to the typhus hut, whispered Mrs. Rimmis.
I sat next to my brother. I rearranged the rags and fishing nets he was covered with.
I'm so tired, Lena, he said. My gums hurt and my teeth ache.
I know. As soon as the storm ends, I'll search for some food.
You need fish. There's plenty of it. Barrels. I just need to steal some. I'm so cold, said Jonas, shivering. And I can't straighten my legs.
I heated chunks of brick and put them under his feet. I took a brick to Janina. Scurvy bruising spotted her face and neck. The tip of her tiny nose was black with frostbite. I kept the fire going. It did little to help. I could use only a small amount of wood to save what we had. I didn't know how long this storm would last. I looked at the empty spot where my mother had lain. Janina's mother, the man who wound his watch, the repeater. Large gaps had appeared on the floor of the yurta. I lay next to Jonas, covering him with my body as we had done for mother. I wrapped my arms around him, holding his hands in mine. The wind slapped against our disintegrating yurta. Snow blew in around us. It couldn't end like this. It couldn't.
What was life asking of me? How could I respond when I didn't know the question? I love you, I whispered to Jonas.
Chapter 84. The storm drew back a day later. Jonas could barely speak. My joints were locked as if frozen.
We have to work today, said Mrs. Rimmis.
We need rations, wood.
Yes, agreed the bald man.
I knew they were right, but I wasn't sure I had the strength. I looked over at Jonas. He lay completely still on a plank, his cheeks hollow, his mouth agape. Suddenly, his eyes opened with a void stare.
Jonas?
I said, sitting up quickly.
A loud commotion stirred outside. I heard male voices and shouting. Jonas's legs moved slightly.
It's okay, I told him, trying to warm his feet. The door to our yurta flew open. A man leaned in. He wore civilian clothing, a fur-lined coat and a thick, full hat.
Any sick in here? He said in Russian.
Yes, said Mrs. Rimmis. We're sick. We need help.
The man walked in. He carried a lantern.
Please, I said. My brother and this little girl have scurvy, and we can't find one of our friends.
The man made his way over to Jonas and Yanina. He exhaled, letting out a string of Russian expletives. He yelled something. An NKVD stuck his head in the door.
Fish, he commanded. Raw fish for these little ones, immediately.
Who else is sick? He looked at me.
I'm okay, I said.
What's your name?
Lina Vilkis.
How old are you?
16.
He surveyed the situation.
I'm going to help you, but there are hundreds sick and dead. I need assistance. Are there any doctors or nurses in camp?
No, only a veterinarian, but...
I stopped. Maybe he was dead.
A veterinarian? That's all?
He looked down, shaking his head.
We can help, said Mrs. Rimmis. We can walk. What about you, old man? I need teams of people to make soup and cut fish. These children need ascorbic acid.
He had asked the wrong person. The bald man wouldn't help anyone. Not even himself. He raised his head.
Yes, I will help, said the bald man.
I looked at him. He stood up.
I will help as long as we tend to these children first, said the bald man, pointing to Jonas and Yanina.
The doctor nodded, kneeling to Jonas.
Will the NKVD allow you to help us?
I asked the doctor.
They have to. I am an inspection officer. I could make a report to the tribunal. They want me to leave and report that everything is fine here, that I saw nothing out of the ordinary. That's what they expect.
His hand moved quickly toward me. I put up my palms, shielding myself.
I am Dr. Samodorov.
His hand was extended for a handshake. I stared at it, stunned by his show of respect. We worked under his supervision. That day, we each had a bowl of pea soup and half a kilo of fish. He helped us store fish for the upcoming storms and plot out a burial yard for more than 100 bodies, including the man who wound his watch. He had frozen to death. The doctor enlisted the help of Ivanks, native hunters and fishermen who lived less than 30 kilometers away. They came on sleds with dogs and brought coats, boots, and supplies. After 10 days, he said he had to move on, that there were other camps with deportees who were suffering. I gave him all the letters I had written to Andrus. He said he would mail them.
And your father?
He asked. He died in prison, in Krasnoyarsk.
How do you know that?
He asked.
Ivanov told my mother.
Ivanov did? Said the doctor, shaking his head.
Do you think he was lying?
I asked quickly.
Oh, I don't know, Lina. I've been to a lot of prisons and camps. None as remote as this. But there are hundreds of thousands of people. I heard a famous accordion player had been shot, only to meet him a couple of months later in a prison. My heart leapt.
That's what I told my mother. Maybe Ivanov was wrong.
Well, I don't know, Lina. But let's just say I've met a lot of dead people.
I nodded and smiled, unable to contain the fountain of hope he had just given me.
Dr. Samodorov, how did you find us?
I asked him.
Nikolai Kretsky, was all he said.
Chapter 85. Jonas slowly began to heal. Janina was speaking again. We buried the man who wound his watch. I clung to the story of the accordion player and visualized my drawings making their way into Papa's hands. I drew more and more, thinking that come spring, perhaps I might be able to send off a message somehow.
You told me those Evenks on the sleds helped the doctor, said Jonas. Maybe they would help us, too. Sounds like they have a lot of supplies.
Yes, maybe they would help us. I had a recurring dream. I saw a male figure coming toward me in the camp through the swirling ice and snow. I always woke before I could see his face, but once I thought I heard Papa's voice.
Now, what sort of sensible girl stands in the middle of the road when it's snowing? Only one whose father is late, I teased.
Papa's face appeared, frosty and red. He carried a small bundle of hay.
I'm not late, he said, putting his arm around me. I'm right on time.
I left the yurta to chop wood. I began my walk through the snow, 5 kilometers to the tree line. That's when I saw it. A tiny sliver of gold appeared between shades of gray on the horizon. I stared at the amber band of sunlight, smiling. The sun had returned. I closed my eyes. I felt Andrus moving close.
I'll see you,
he said.
Yes, I will see you, I whispered. I will.
I reached into my pocket and squeezed the stone. Epilogue. April 25th, 1995. Kaunas, Lithuania.
What are you doing? Keep moving or we won't finish today, said the man.
Construction vehicles roared behind him.
I found something, said the digger, staring into the hole.
He knelt down for a closer look.
What is it? I don't know.
The man lifted a wooden box from the ground. He pried the hinge top open and looked inside. He removed a large glass jar full of papers. He opened the jar and began to read. Dear friend, the writings and drawings you hold in your hands were buried in the year 1954, after returning from Siberia with my brother, where we were imprisoned for 12 years. There are many thousands of us, nearly all dead. Those alive cannot speak. Though we committed no offense, we are viewed as criminals. Even now, speaking of the terrors we have experienced would result in our death. So we put our trust in you, the person who discovers this capsule of memories sometime in the future. We trust you with the truth, for contained herein is exactly that, the truth. My husband, Andrus, says that evil will rule until good men or women choose to act. I believe him. This testimony was written to create an absolute record, to speak in a world where our voices have been extinguished. These writings may shock or horrify you, but that is not my intention. It is my greatest hope that the pages in this jar stir your deepest well of human compassion. I hope they prompt you to do something, to tell someone. Only then can we ensure that this kind of evil is never allowed to repeat itself. Sincerely, Mrs. Lina Arvidus, 9th day of July, 1954, Kaunas.
This is a story of extreme suffering and tremendous hope. The atrocities of Hitler and the Nazis are well known, but many people don't know that Joseph Stalin killed over 20 million people during his reign of terror. People often say to me, Ruta, I know my history. How is it that I have never heard this story before? I've always been interested in my Lithuanian heritage, and growing up in the States with a name like Ruta Sepetys, which in Lithuanian is Ruta Šepetys, has always raised questions. People hear my name and they say, what are you? And I answer, I'm Lithuanian. So it's always been a part of my identity. But it was when I was in Lithuania meeting with cousins and I naively asked, so, do you have any photos of my grandparents or of my father? And the room suddenly became very quiet. And they said, no, Ruta, we had to burn them all. We couldn't let anyone know that we were related to your grandfather. And that's when I knew that I had to tell this story. The Baltic countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia are located just under Finland on the western side of Russia, and they are a warm water port to the Atlantic. In 1939, Hitler and Stalin signed a pact of non-aggression, and Stalin got the Baltics. So in 1940, the Baltics were annexed into the Soviet Union, and the countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia disappeared from maps. Stalin drafted lists of those he considered anti-Soviet, and those included military personnel, doctors, lawyers, business owners, teachers, librarians, even priests and children. And they had committed no crime. They were all arrested, the men separated from the women. Everyone was stuffed into cattle cars. The men went to prison, and the women were sent to Siberia. And with no risk of pregnancy, Stalin's plan for genocide would be complete. However, he underestimated their will to live. The Baltics were under Soviet occupation for over 50 years until 1990-1991. Those who suffered didn't dare breathe a word of it in fear of the Soviet secret police. But some brave people buried the story or incorporated it into art and music. And in my book, the main character is a 15-year-old artist, and she documents her entire experience through her drawings and her letters, and she buries it in a jar, hoping that one day someone will discover it and the world will know the truth. I did a lot of research in writing the book, and I took a couple trips to Lithuania. I met with survivors, historians, family members, members of parliament. I spent time in an actual train car that was used for the deportations, and I also spent time in a Soviet prison. There were so many labor camps across Siberia. I decided to write about the people who were deported to the Arctic because the conditions were just so unfathomable. One survivor in particular, Irena, spent hours with me, and she gave me such vivid detail, and I was so moved. And I've incorporated quite a few details that Irena told me about her family's experience into the novel. It took me a year to write the book, and then I revised it quite a bit. In fact, when I turned in the first draft of this book, you know, we laughed and said it was the Lithuanian version of Wuthering Heights. It was so dark. So I had to revise quite a bit, which I love. I love revising as much as I love writing. I look for characters that might not be classically beautiful, but have a beautiful capacity to love, if that makes sense. And these people in Lithuania, they were both. They were beautiful, and they had a beautiful capacity to love and to teach love and to teach kindness in an atmosphere of cruelty. In my interviews with survivors, from time to time, I would find someone who told me that someone from the NKVD had secretly helped them in some way or showed them some form of kindness. And that really interested me, and that person was a hero to me, and that's also how I came up with the title of the book, because between shades of gray, sometimes there's a small crack that can let the love shine in. I met with a survivor who told me that his baby brother had died, and they made a coffin for him, and in the morning, they found his body lying on the ground. And someone had stolen the baby's coffin for firewood. And I was shocked and immediately said, well, weren't you angry? And he said, Ruta, how could I be angry? That firewood might have saved someone's life that night. It's incredible that anybody survived these camps in the Arctic. I tell people, read the book and ask yourself, would I survive? Because my grandfather was part of the Lithuanian military, he would have been executed by Stalin. So he escaped with my grandmother and my father, and my grandfather never went back to Lithuania.
We left because my father was a high-ranking officer, and when the Russians occupied it in 1940, they were arresting the officers and executing them outside of Kaunas. I think it's difficult to understand what freedom is because there are so many things that we take for granted, and until somebody takes them away, we just assume that's part of life. Freedom is not appreciated until you lose it.
People have asked, you know, what's your goal in writing this obscure story? And I've said that my dream would be for this story to find its way into libraries and schools and to teachers, so this part of history won't be lost. I know that this novel has a lot of brutality, but to me, I see equal portions of love in this novel. And to me, I do see it as a love story, for whether love of God, love of country, love of another human being. Love reveals to us the miraculous nature of the human spirit. And I know it sounds cheesy, but I truly believe that love can save your life. You know, to love something so deeply and so much that it becomes the very life within you that sustains you. That shows us that love is the most powerful army. And it's not about bombing, it's about believing. I grew up in Michigan, spent many years in LA, and now I live in Tennessee. This is my first novel. I've actually worked in the music business for 20 years, trying to find the courage to send my writing to someone. And I wrote the book, but really, history wrote this story. And I am so grateful to Philomel and Penguin and Writer's House and the many publishers worldwide who have taken a chance on me and are helping me bring this story out of the dark. Please stop.
This is Emily Klein. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Between Shades of Gray by Ruta Sepetys. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Music by Nils Benilson. Between Shades of Gray is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2011. All rights reserved. The book Between Shades of Gray is available wherever Philomel books are sold.